case number 12-5017. Abdul Rahim Abdul Razak Al Janko, appellant versus Robert M. Gates, former Secretary of Defense et al. Mr. Hoffman for the appellant, Ms. Foster for the appellees.
Let's wait till the courtroom clears. All right, Mr. Hoffman, you've come all the way from Venice, California.
That's true, Your Honor.
Welcome.
Good morning, Your Honor. Paul Hoffman for Mr. Janko. Mr. Janko comes before the court with a unique set of facts. He has a habeas determination by Judge Leon, not appealed by the government, which shows that he has always was, detained improperly, in the sense that he was, in fact, at the time of September 11th, 2001, already serving a 25-year sentence for being alleged by the Taliban to be a U.S. and Israeli spy, and suffered torture during that time. His confession was broadcast in the United Arab Emirates. The transcript of his trial and confession were published prior to that, so there's no dispute about any of those things. And the habeas decision makes clear that it was not based on subsequent facts. It's based on basically undisputed facts by the government that this is what happened. So in those circumstances, our position, first of all, with respect to the Military Commissions Act, is that there is a determination now that he was not properly detained at any time. And therefore should not be barred in bringing his claims for relief from his unlawful detention and treatment during his more than 7 years of U.S. custody, both initially in Afghanistan and then later in Guantanamo Bay. The main argument that's been made against that position is that it is only the United States, meaning the executive branch, that can make that decision. And our view, as we've set forth in the briefs, is that United States ordinarily means more than just the executive branch. And if you look at the plain language, it includes a habeas decision made by a judge of the district court, and again, not appealed by the government.
What do you do with the government's argument that E2 uses the word United States, words United States three times and court once, so Congress knew the difference between court and United States? That's the government's argument.
Well, I think the answer to that
is, in other words, they would have said and has been determined by a court to have been improperly detained.
Well, the reason they may have used United States, which ordinarily includes courts, is that there were processes within the executive branch about this, but there was also a reference in E2 to the role of this court, of the D.C. Circuit, in some circumstances, with respect to the DTA.
You say E2 mentions this court?
Well, it mentions a procedure in which this court has a role. And so by using United States, not only did the Congress use a term that ordinarily includes all branches of government as appropriate, it also used the term that meant that in the future, I mean, this was a time of turbulence in terms of procedures. It was not clear what kinds of procedures would be used, and they had been changed. So the United States leaves open the possibility that a court could make this determination. And in addition to plain language, I mean, one of our positions is you now have a decision by a court showing that there was not a proper determination in the CSRT process, which was, and we've explained all the different ways in which he was denied due process in that action. And we've also laid out several constitutional arguments.
Before you go to the constitutional argument, what about the government's argument that the even if there is some ambiguity about what the word United States, I mean the two words United States means, that the earlier version of the statute did expressly refer to this court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, but it no longer does, and there's legislative history indicating that Congress did this in order to make clear that this was to be a determination by the executive branch.
Our position, as I think we've set forth in the briefs, is that the legislative history is not as clear as the government has argued. Uh-huh. But we can see that there is legislative history supporting their position. But Senator Cronin, for example, also put an emphasis about the fact that there needed to be a proper determination. He wasn't talking about any kind of determination. In fact, the government's position is that it really could be any determination. And that means the determination, for example, by a soldier or an officer in Kandahar, that's it. And that doesn't make any sense. And so what we think the court is dealing with is a statute written as it is, and trying to determine what Congress had in mind is not as clear as that. And that this term United States should be seen as including, as it usually does, the courts, who now have this responsibility through the habeas process. And so the question is, and the reason I mentioned the constitutional arguments was not necessarily to get into all of them, but to say that there are serious questions where you've got a CSRT process that we believe violates due process standards and access to the courts, where you've got a finding by a court applying due process standards in a fair hearing that shows that this man was not ever properly determined to be an enemy combatant. In fact, he was in prison beforehand for being a U.S. spy. We think that between using the words, they could easily have used other words. They could have said the executive branch. They could have said the CSRTs are final. They could have said, and they did in other places, use the CSRTs, both in prior versions and others. So the same argument applies to the government's position. Instead, what they ultimately did and put into the habeas statute was a provision that refers to the United States, and it refers to a determination, a proper determination. And the government tends to ignore the word proper, and we think the legislative history also exhibits a concern that there be one. And so you have here a determination that he never was, and you have a system that was lacking in due process that had decided that he should be there. To just move on briefly, since I don't have a lot of time, on the other issues, if the court agrees with us that Mr. Janko is not barred by E2 in the Military Commissions Act, and we think this, by the way, is an issue that this court has not yet decided in the context of someone like Mr. Janko, who's in these unique circumstances. Our position on the alien tort statute, and to some degree it's the same kind of argument on the Bivens claims, is that there are parts of the alien tort statute claims and parts of the Bivens claims that are no doubt barred by this court's prior decisions, particularly the period of time from 2002 to 2004. Our position really is that with respect to the scope of employment issue, for whether the alien tort statute applies to individual defendants, is that's something for which discovery was needed, both to find out the motivations, for example, which of these acts should really be found to be within the scope of employment. For example, is urinating on detainees within the scope of employment, is setting him up to have other inmates throw fecal material at him because of the fact that he was claimed to be a U.S. spy. Is that the kind of thing that was within the scope of employment? And we think that the test for that should have been applied. And it's different from Razul in the sense that in Razul, this court was dealing with a situation where you had the very beginning stages of an interrogation process. In our case, we have a man who was in Guantanamo for more than seven years, long past any interrogation process, where his situation really became much like any other prisoner. And on the Bivens side, we think that at least at some point in this process, particularly towards the end, his situation is not different in any material sense from the Carlson versus Green situation, where the court has long allowed Bivens actions for constitutional violations that occur within the prison context. And he was basically a prisoner. He wasn't being interrogated at the end. And he should get the same rights. And we recognize that the government has argued that Kiemba finds that there's no due process rights. And our view on that is that both Kiemba and Al-Madwani arise in a different due process context. And so it's not clear that those are holdings that say that there's no due process rights, including core due process rights to physical integrity and other rights. I see that
Tony, once again, just so sure. I totally understand your argument. We have there's a very powerful rule of statutory interpretation that different words mean different things in the statute. And I asked you at the beginning, this E2 uses the word court once in the United States three times. And we normally apply that canon of statutory construction, we would say, okay, United States doesn't mean court because Congress used court separately. And I need to understand what your best argument is about that.
I think our best argument, Your Honor, is that the United States ordinarily encompasses more than just the executive branch, mm-hmm. and that if Congress was intent on only including the executive branch in that determination, they could easily have said so, as they did in other drafts and in other areas of the legislation. And United States ordinarily does include courts. So that's our position. And in statutes, the same word can mean different things depending on the context. And obviously in the context of a determination, that courts do that. Executive branch does that too. Courts ordinarily don't detain people, so the reference to the United States in terms of an alien detained by the United States, ordinarily that would mean a branch of the government that detains. But our position is that United States, in the context of a proper determination, should be seen as including the district court and the finding of habeas, and particularly when you add the doctrine of constitutional avoidance to avoid the difficult constitutional issues that would be raised if, in fact, Congress said that there should be no access to courts in this situation based on a system that was plagued with the due process limitations, or really a complete absence of due process in the CSRT system as laid out in our complaint and in our brief.
We'll give you a minute in reply if you want. All right, Ms. Foster?
May it please the Court, Sydney Foster for the United States, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, and the other named individual defendants, all of whom are sued personally for money damages. Your Honors, there are numerous grounds on which this court can affirm the district court's judgment here. I'd like to start by addressing the jurisdictional bar in 28 U.S.C. Section 2241 E2. This court in Al-Zahrani and the Ninth Circuit in Hamad have recognized that determinations by combatant status review tribunals that an individual is an enemy combatant are determinations of the United States within the meaning of Section 2241E2 that can trigger application of the jurisdictional bar.
Right, but the statute says to have been properly detained.
That's correct.
And the argument the petitioner is making here is that the district court's grant of writ of habeas corpus means that he was not properly detained.
That's right. That's the argument. The key is that the statute makes the jurisdiction, under the statute, the jurisdictional bar is triggered when there has been a determination by the United States that an individual, an alien has been determined by the United States to have been properly detained as an enemy combatant. There's two reasons that a habeas grant isn't relevant to that question, and one is that the United States reference in the language I just quoted is a reference purely to the executive branch, and so it's only an executive branch determination.
Plays no role in the statute.
Right. I think that's right, Your Honor, but I think plaintiffs...
Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
The word properly plays a role in the statute, for sure, but plaintiff's counsel seems to be misunderstanding kind of where in the statute...
Let me just... suppose if the tribunal... Here the tribunal ruled that he was properly detained, right?
Correct.
If the tribunal thought he hadn't been properly detained, it would have so ruled, correct?
That's correct.
So... under what circumstances would there ever be a determination? In other words, any determination by a combatant status review tribunal to keep someone is based on assumption that it was proper, correct?
That's correct. Because the way the CSERs...
So properly in your view, because if we didn't think it was proper, he wouldn't be in Guantanamo, right?
Right. If the CSER concluded that the detention
under your interpretation, the word plays no role in the statute.
Absolutely, it plays a role in the statute. The determination that is required to trigger application of the statute is a determination that detention was proper.
No, but my point is, I don't mean to belabor this, but my point is that if the tribunal did not think the detainee was properly detained, we would never have a case like this.
That's correct. If there had been, well, that may be correct. That we wouldn't then be relying on that tribunal's decision to trigger application of the statute. If there were a prior tribunal, for example, that had come to the opposite conclusion, then we would be relying on that prior tribunal's determination, because under the plain terms of the statute, any determination by the executive branch that an individual was properly detained as an enemy combatant, or which is equivalent to a determination by a, or it can be satisfied by a determination by a CSERT that an individual is an enemy combatant, because embedded in such a determination is that the detention is proper, that any such determination would trigger application of the statute.
Would this apply, in the government's view, to the original determination to detain the person? All the way back to being detained in Afghanistan?
Right, so, I mean, this case doesn't present the question.
I know it doesn't.
Right. We're not saying that a soldier's battlefield decision that someone should be, taken into custody, that would qualify as a determination that he was properly detained as an enemy combatant. That wouldn't be, based on a legal determination that an individual is lawfully detained.
What about the Supreme Court's statement that these CRTs are error-prone?
The Supreme
and
Court.
And so, why would Congress want to set up a system whereby a federal district court judge's determination is ignored?
Well, there are a couple answers. I mean, A, to clarify, the Supreme Court in Boumediene held that the C certs were not sufficient together with the DTA review to provide an adequate alternative to habeas. The Supreme Court expressly did not decide whether the C certs comply with due process. It was very rational for Congress to.
That wasn't my question, was it?
What's that?
About constitutional due process. My question is just the statutory language.
Right.
And counsel's argument that, you know, things were up in the air at this time, so United States, in one part of this section, United States is talking about who is a defendant only.
There are three references to
so
the United States.
So the three references in context may mean different things, even though the same words are used, is what I'm getting at.
Right. Well, I think, though, I mean, that, you know, there, as this court held in Microsoft, you know, this court should generally try to interpret the same term that's used the same, you know, in multiple places in the statute
in
the same way.
Well, under that theory, then we would have to read the United States as meaning more than the executive branch, right?
I don't think that's true, Your Honor. If you look at the other two instances where United States mm-hmm. is used in Section 2241E2, so first we have that the bar applies only when the action is relating to an alien who is or was detained by the United States. And it's the executive branch, of course, who's detaining the plaintiff here. It's not, you know, the judicial branch. It's not all branches of the government. The other place where United States appears in the statute is that it bars actions against the United States or its agents. And again, there, in the context, it's clear that the bar here was meant to bar actions against executive branch officials who were involved in the detention of the military detainees at issue here. So this court, consistent with its decision in Microsoft, should interpret the term United States to be the same in all three of those circumstances. And I'll note that the enactment history and the legislative history help explain, make very clear that that's precisely what Congress was trying to do when it used the word United States. As Judge Tatel was noting, the prior version of Section 2241E2 that was part of the Detainee Treatment Act made the jurisdictional bar triggered based on either an individual's current custody in military detention or a determination by this court under the DTA that an individual was properly detained as an enemy combatant. Now, the legislative history explains that Congress made the shift from that language referencing this court to the United States precisely because there were problems that that flowed from having the determination at issue that triggered application of the statute be a determination by this court, including Congress's concern that these actions were impeding military efforts and should be barred based on simply just as long as there was an initial determination that the detention was proper. And again,
I know, but what's unusual about this case is the way the district court framed his opinion in granting habeas, as distinct from saying he is no longer properly held.
That's right. Although the district court didn't purport to be reviewing the determination of either of the combatant status review tribunals.
Implicitly?
I mean, nor implicitly. I mean, Your Honor, there was, if it was, you know, the way habeas review has proceeded under Boumediene is that it's not a review. It could have perhaps proceeded that way.
But the judge said he would never properly deter.
I think the language.
You don't agree that that's fairly broad language for a district court judge to use? Well, I haven't seen it before in any of these habeas decisions.
I would have, I'm sorry, Your Honor, you'd have to point me to the precise language that the district court used. I know that there's a lot of language that the district court used where the district court's focusing on the point at which plaintiff was captured. But I think plaintiff's counsel's misunderstanding the significance of those references. The court properly focused on whether a plaintiff was part of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or an associated force at the time he was captured, because the court, as opposed to some earlier time, such as the time when plaintiff admitted that he was at an Al-Qaeda training camp, or at, you know, the time where plaintiff admitted he was at a Taliban guest house, that approach of the district court was consistent with the approach this court has since adopted in Salahi, which holds that the inquiry into whether someone's part of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated force must focus on the time of capture as opposed to some earlier period to With the idea being that, you know, if someone was at one time part of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or an associated force, but somehow disassociates altogether, then that person wouldn't be lawfully detained. So there is a lot of language in the district court opinion that does focus on the time of capture, but I think if you're reading that language in context, it's clear that what the district court's focusing on the time of capture because that's the time where the district court must analyze the associations between plaintiff and Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and associated forces. The district court did not review the initial decision to take plaintiff into detention, did not review the CSIRT determinations. There's no discussion of them whatsoever. And so the district court, consistent with the approach of district courts in all of these habeas cases, was simply concluding that petitioner was not lawfully detained based on the evidence that was before the district court at the time that it issued its ruling in 2009 or around that time.
Suppose there were specific allegations of mistreatment after the grant of habeas corpus, and while he was still detained.
Uh-huh.
Then how would this work?
With respect to the jurisdictional argument? Your Honor, I don't think that there would, I'm not sure that there would be any difference there. The jurisdictional bar would still apply because it would be triggered. It's triggered solely based on a determination by the executive branch that the individual is lawfully detained. And
you are consistent.
Okay. I try. Yeah. If I could just address one final point, unless you have further questions about Section 2241E2. But one just final point I wanted to address is actually related to plaintiff's exhaustion argument, which this court doesn't need to reach. But I just want to note that we had argued in our response brief that the district court's judgment, dismissal of the alien tort statute claims could be dismissed on the ground that the record did not establish that plaintiff had exhausted those claims. In plaintiff's reply brief, plaintiff asserted a new argument that hadn't been asserted in district court or in the opening brief that
but
he actually...
But it was an issue.
What's that?
You raised it in your brief, so he responded.
Right, no, and that's fine. I just want to clarify our position on the issue, and so I'm just giving the background. So the plaintiff raised this in response to the argument that he had, in fact, exhausted those claims just at the same time in the same complaint that was filed.
Are you saying you weren't aware of that?
I was not aware of it, but we have looked at it since then. It's not the actual complaint under the administrative complaints and not in the record, but we have looked at it since then, and we do agree that that was sufficient to exhaust those claims. So we no longer think this court should affirm the dismissal of those claims on those grounds. They can be affirmed on the multiple other grounds that we addressed in our brief.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Go ahead.
Well, just quickly, Your Honor, the argument that the United States involves something about the CSRT process or doesn't involve a soldier on the ground, I mean, there's nothing in the statute that says that. I mean, and the government has taken a position that any determination at any point by someone in the executive branch could trigger this bar. And I guess the reason I'm mentioning that is that the language that that Congress actually used is the broader language that includes others, and it may be that there are lots of reasons why they may have done that, but the normal use of that language would include courts, and it could be they were contemplating that the courts would play a continuing role at some point. I mean, clearly the D.C. Circuit was still playing some role under the DTA in E2, and this is a habeas statute that was for a longer period of time. And I guess their reading really does wipe out the idea of a proper determination. The word proper just doesn't make any sense in the particular context of this case.
It could mean, as she argues it, the United States determined detaining was proper. That's the issue.
Right, and obviously you have.
I don't agree with that. But that's
well, we don't. And I guess I finished by. I think that the decision below is uniquely specific about the fact that our client never should have been in detention, never should have been in detention in Afghanistan, never should have been in detention in Guantanamo. The United States has ruined his life. And so the real question here is does the MCA wipe out somebody in his situation who's never had a proper determination other than the one that says he never should have been in custody, and wipe out any claim for possible relief of any sort? And I think that the legislators that were concerned about proper determinations, because they were, even those that wanted to restrict courts were concerned about proper determinations, would not have had Mr. Janko in mind when they enacted the Military Commissions Act. Thank you.